Welcome to Chats from the Mat, yoga-inspired conversations with Brian McRae Davis.
Amy lives in a van with her husband. They have been traveling the U.S., teaching as they go, for almost 2 years. In our conversation, she talks about some of the joys and challenges of this lifestyle. Her experience in and after college, managing dance performances, prepared her to run festivals, and she has been running the Divine Play Acro Yoga Festival for the last 4 years. She has also just released a new exercise modality with Acro Yoga founder Jason Niemer. As you would expect from someone with such a varied life experience, the conversation we have is enjoyable and insightful. I hope that you enjoy the fourth episode of the podcast, Chats from the Mat, Yoga-Inspired Conversations, with me, Brian McRae Davis. Amy, where are you from?
As in, where was I born? Chicago, Illinois. I'm currently traveling full-time. I say I'm from Nomad Island.
How did you get from Chicago to Nomad Island?
From Chicago to Nomad Island. The short version, because you're asking basically for my entire life story, would be I discovered the West Coast when I was sort of a hippie and went on Grateful Dead tour. Ended up in Oregon, became a dance major. From dance major, found yoga. From yoga, found acro yoga. And I felt like acro yoga was actually invented for me to combine dance and yoga. And using my technical background skills that I learned in college, I launched my career into the acro yoga world full on, and now I'm on Nomad Island.
How long have you been living in a van?
1 year and 7 months.
And if I understand correctly, you plan on continuing to live in a van for a little while, so I'm assuming that means that you enjoy it.
I do enjoy it very much. I have a very loose idea of how long I might live in a van, and it continually changes due to my nature of planning. I continue to plan things that make van life very accessible, and I do see in the end that eventually I'm going to want a kitchen and a giant garden.
For those that find the idea of living in a van romantic and exciting, can you give us a brief idea of the things that lived up to your expectations and maybe a few things that you found challenging that you weren't expecting to?
I really appreciate being outside. So for me, being in a van and using a hotspot and being able to do all of my daily office work 40 hours a week on a computer outside in very natural places has been one of the major highlights. I've enjoyed really becoming more minimalist, less stuff all around and everything. Challenges, definitely some challenges. I don't always get to wake up and take that really steaming hot shower that I love. And bathtubs are very far and in between. Hot water dishes and cold weather, cold hands, that kind of stuff has been a little bit challenging. But overall, I still really enjoy it.
One of the things that's always intimidated me about that sort of lifestyle is weather. You must end up at some location for a few days. What happens when the weather doesn't cooperate?
By not cooperate, you mean it's pouring rain and I still have to get outside of the van and set up the stove to make my meals. That means I've invested in really good rain gear, and there's no such thing as bad weather, just bad gear.
So regardless of what the weather's doing, there are certain things that you have to do. And if cooking being one of them, that means you have to go outside to do that.
Yes.
Now, you've also been traveling for a little while with your partner and now husband. What's it like being contained in the space with someone for that long?
You learn the power of silence often, because you cannot be 24/7 with one person no matter how much you love them and not need solo independent time, at least for me personally. So the challenges in there would be like crawling into the back of the van, putting on headphones and dropping into like my own private space. We do take time away from each other in nature. I might go for a hike. He might go for a different hike. Those things are definitely challenging. Overall, I think we've done a really good job of learning how to communicate our needs. It was definitely challenging in the beginning. The space is not so big. And there are those moments when it is freezing cold outside and you don't really want to get out and go away. If you're sitting in a beautiful location, you're like, here we are. What do we do now? Why don't you just be quiet for a little while? Let's talk about this random place that we've never been and dream about how we could get closer to warm weather. There's an ebb and flow.
So it sounds like it's one of those situations that either cultivates good communication or fixes the relationship very quickly.
Yes, I would say that if we didn't like each other, that would have been really apparent within probably the first 3 months. And given that it's been a year and 7 months and our van is a minivan, I would say that we've actually really cultivated a much stronger relationship as a result.
Okay, let's backtrack a little bit. Would you describe to me your first exposure to yoga?
My very first exposure to yoga when I was, I knew about yoga, but my actual physical experience of yoga was when I was a dance major in college, and it was an option in the dance department to take an add-on yoga class. It was Ashtanga yoga. I took it for 3 months with my entire household. There were 6 of us, and we would get up every day, ride our bikes to yoga. After 6 months of Ashtanga, I loved yoga. My roommates all thought I was crazy, and they never went again. And from there, I just continued to practice Ashtanga, and then it evolves as you get more into yoga. You find out there's all these other forms of yoga.
Initially, was it always through the university?
It was through the university for the first year and a half, and then my travel nature made me more curious, so I started looking on the internet and was like, oh, there's this teacher doing this thing here, and I started to travel a little bit more for other teachers.
And how long after your first exposure to a classroom of yoga practice did you become a teacher?
I'd say probably 4.5 years of steady daily practice, and then I started to pursue teacher training.
Why did you pursue teacher training?
I was already teaching in the dance department and teaching dance and movement and lighting design, and I love being a teacher and sharing information with others and the value that students bring to you if you're open to them being your teachers as well. And I wanted to share the joy that I found in practicing yoga with other people.
So when you went into a teacher training program, was your intention to bring it back to the university, or did you have some other idea?
Actually, my other idea was I had been in Oregon for a long time doing technical theater in addition to teaching dance and spent a lot of time in the dark, and I went to teacher training as my breakaway point from Oregon to move to California in the Bay Area. There's not a lot of yoga teachers. So I moved to the Bay Area, Santa Cruz, and with the intention of starting a new career in yoga.
Part of the incentive then was to move away from dance?
To take a break from what I've been doing more than take to move away from dance. To just shift it a little bit, be more in my body, more than in my head, and more than being in the dark with lighting design, because I've been doing a lot of that and wanted to just do something completely different. So I let go of the other career to start a brand new one.
So when you say being in the dark with the lighting design, does that refer to actually being in the dark, or is that not being in front of students? What do you mean?
It was actually really being in the dark in a black box theater, teaching people how to do lighting design for dance, running backstage production, stage management. So literally, like, a lot of time in the dark looking up at bright lights.
When you graduated your teacher training program, how did your yoga teaching career begin?
I contacted all of the studios in Santa Cruz, California. I was very adamant that I wanted to teach Ashtanga because that was the way that I'd been trained. It turns out that not everybody wants to do that style of practice, and only one studio was open to actually adding an Ashtanga yoga practice to their schedule. So I began with one small studio, one student a week, 2 students a week, 3 students a week for a little while until it began to build.
So that's fairly typical for a lot of teachers, where they start off very small and they start off with very small classes, and then it very gradually grows. For that person that's looking to break into the teacher training break into teaching, or for the person that's maybe feeling some frustration about that, can you describe to that person what it was like and how it grew?
I believe having teaching experience in a different field already, I realized that if you value what you're offering and you continue to hold that space and you come into each class with that enthusiasm and joy that you're bringing to your own practice and that desire to share, it's a lot about just being committed and believing in yourself and teaching really good classes, whether it's one person or 120 people, because each person has the same amount of value in your class. And that one student might bring their friend next week and they might bring 2 friends. So it's a little bit about perseverance. And I would recommend that you have another job initially and not just quit all of your other jobs and be a full-fledged yoga teacher, because it's a little bit challenging on the financial end in the beginning.
So you had one studio that was supporting you. Did you put on more classes at that one studio, or did you find it easier then once Ashtanga started to take hold to move into other studios?
I stayed at that one studio initially for quite a while and really built up the Ashtanga aspect of that studio. At the same time, like I just mentioned about having other income, I I've come from a rock climbing background as well, and I started working at a rock climbing gym and became the manager of their yoga studio, which was brand new, which opened my eyes to all sorts of other yoga teachers and ways to take all of my dance training, what I learned about yoga, and start to develop a little bit more different style of teaching. And from Ashtanga, I did offer initially at the climbing gym. It's a very strong practice, not necessarily suited for all the climbers in the community. So I started to do a little bit more less strict Ashtanga, which slowly evolved into more of a core conditioning, bendy, stretchy, let's get in our body and make us better climber style of yoga.
Let's pause there for a minute. So teaching at a yoga studio, really the teacher has free rein to create their class and to develop what they're interested in. It sounds like at the climbing gym that you were starting to tailor the classes for a particular clientele. How did you recognize what they needed, and what did those classes start to look like?
As the new of the new studio, and we ran a survey, anybody who wanted to participate, with a lot of questions, like what would be of service to their bodies as climbers? Do they want to be stronger? Do they want to become more flexible? Tight shoulders, tight hips, wanted to be core stronger. And so from there, we started to develop classes that were more climber appropriate. We also did offer a full range of other styles of yoga, but the classes that became tailored specifically for the climbers definitely grew the most. And from that, climbers felt like, oh, well, I'm doing this class where they're being really kind to my tight shoulders and the fact that my arms won't reach over my head because my lats are really large. They started to realize that yoga was more available to them than they realized and would start to go to more traditional hatha or ashtanga style classes.
So you created a gateway drug.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Okay.
We even called it yoga for climbers. Very creative.
Good marketing. Okay, so some teachers become reluctant to, they feel restrict the class to a particular population like that. You know, they feel like they want to open up to everyone. Do you feel like it's better then to focus on a niche?
In that particular instance, yes. Climbers have this different, I mean, this is a generalization, of course, but yoga's not for me. There's nothing there that I can do. So by calling it something for climbers, it really was like, oh, there's a style of yoga that's just for climbers. And really, it was just yoga with some adaptations to address tightness for climbers. So it's a trick more than anything.
Well, I think that's a great point. When you have yoga for runners, yoga for climbers, yoga for people that sit on the couch a lot, it's more or less the same class. You just recognize there's certain strengths or weaknesses that need to be addressed and moved around.
Yep, exactly.
Did you ever return to the world of dance?
Yes. Actually, fairly recently, I realized maybe a year ago how much I missed dancing. And a friend of mine gave me, it's kind of a funny story, but he gave me a pair of really flowy pants. And I was staying at a studio apartment with a lot of open space. The song came on and I just got up and started like moving. And all of a sudden, like my modern dancer movement brain was like, whoa. Why have you not been doing this? And then since there, I've been dancing a lot more.
For yourself or for others teaching?
Primarily for myself, although I did just recently go and reconnect with more of my performance side of dancing in Montreal. I took something called an Acro Yoga Dance Camp where I found that joy of the connection of the Acro Yoga and the dance and returned to stage, got to do a little bit of lighting design, realized that it was good to take a break from all of those things, but I can see that they're still really part of who I am and bring me joy.
So how long has it been from when you took the break from dance and then just reacquainted yourself with it?
10 years, give or take.
Actually, that provides a nice segue. Let's talk about how you found Acro Yoga.
Because I was the yoga manager and the manager of the rock climbing gym, a woman came to my yoga for climbing class. It was right away very apparent that she really didn't need a specific class. She definitely had the yoga background. She was super flexy, bendy, really, really strong. And afterwards, she came up to me and said, I just came here to talk to you privately. I want to bring Acro Yoga to this gym. And I was like, what's Acro Yoga? So we did a tiny bit of Acro Yoga. I was like, oh, that seems cool. We can try that. And we offered a demo, like a show and tell at the rock climbing gym, her and another Acro Yoga instructor. And afterwards, they were trying to get people to play, fly, and or base. And nobody wanted to. And I was like, well, as the manager of the gym, I should probably at least do it because then other people will see that I'm doing it. They might want to try it. And I flew everything that they had just demoed and then laid down, put my feet up in the air, and then I based everything that they had just demoed, and they both, those instructors, like, you should be an acro yoga teacher because this is something apparently that you like to do. And I'm, you can be a teacher in acro yoga? What does that mean?
Okay, so first a quick little side note, and for any teachers out there that are looking to break into new spaces, I want to say that that's a really phenomenal way of doing that, which is first of all to meet the person in charge by taking their class, and second of all having a conversation with them. So any prospective teachers out there, just make a note of that. I think it might be, in my opinion, one of the best ways to break into a space. Would you agree? Or
yeah, and it might change your whole life too.
And it might change your whole life, okay.
In a good way.
Okay, so you found acro yoga. They introduced you to acro yoga. Between that point and teacher training, what happened with respect to acro yoga?
I began, well, we brought the acro yoga instructors in to start teaching a class. Maybe 3 or 4 weeks later, we started a series, and they asked me to be their assistant, which I really had no idea what that meant. So I began assisting the classes regularly for 6 months. During that time, I applied for the acro yoga teacher training. I did get accepted, but I got a really long list of things I would need to do. I got accepted in February, and I had until August to meet all of these extra requirements. So I did a lot of the prep work. The requirements were really high at that level. So I did a lot of private hiring of massage to get caught up in massage technique, and worked on opening my shoulders so that I would be able to actually do the inversions required in acro yoga teacher training. And yeah, it was a lot of work and worth all of it.
Now you're describing it in very dry detail, but I'm guessing since you applied for the teacher training soon after you saw your first exposure, there must have been an emotional response to it.
Definitely. I felt like my dance background, in addition to doing modern dance, I did a lot of contact improvisation and improvisational work. And then having been really immersed in the yoga for so long, I felt like contact, modern dance, and yoga got together and made this amazing creative way to unite all of those things that I liked. And I was like, oh my gosh, acro yoga, dance, yoga, like all combined together, but with friends and partners and spotters for safety. And oh my gosh. And I just immediately felt like it was something I was supposed to go do.
What is your position within the acro yoga organization right now?
I am the acro yoga festival director. This will be my 5th year coming into that, and I am also the AcroFit program director and lead trainer.
First of all, would you describe AcroFit?
AcroFit is partner fitness with an acrobatic flavor.
Okay, now, one of the main reasons that I wanted to talk to you, besides enjoying our conversations, was that I wanted to provide some information to people about the running of festivals. So would you, let's start at the beginning. How did you get into running festivals?
My background when I was working at the university in Oregon was not only in dance, but also in technical theater. I had done an internship at Jacob's Pillow. I really loved the backstage, like behind the scenes creativity that comes with that kind of planning. So having done that for, I think, 8 years, I already had like an organizational brain to create events. I had attended and taught at the first 3 acro yoga festivals, and I was waiting for the dates to be launched for year number 4, and I sent an email to acro yoga, are we having a festival this year, because I need to plan my teaching touring schedule. And it had always been in the Bay Area. I was like, I could always help if we needed someone to help, and me offering to help turned into a conversation with the manager and the co-founder of acro yoga. Would you be interested in not only helping, but actually producing it this next year? And how do you feel about moving it to another state? And I was like, I guess that means we're having it if I say yes. And if I say no, what happens then? So I said yes, not really knowing at all what I was signing up for.
I'd imagine that the amount of work required for a festival is exponentially more than running a dance production, or am I wrong on that?
They're similar. The major differences in running a dance production, especially through a university setting, is that there's the educational component. And so you are guaranteed additional staff because there are students who need credits. Whereas in running a festival, it's been much more of how much can you figure out right now and who can you find to maybe want to help you. So there is definitely a similar, but I would say the festival in the current capacity that it's running is more work.
Okay, so before we get in too deep into some of these things, what is the name of the festival?
The Divine Play Acro Yoga Festival.
And so right now that's happening in Portland.
Portland, Oregon, October 6th, 7th, and 8th. We also have a smaller festival running in Jamaica.
When?
April 18th to the 23rd.
Okay. Now, you moved it from the Bay Area up to Portland. How did that happen? How'd you do it?
The last year that I was in California, 25-plus acroyogis from Portland, Oregon showed up wearing matching shirts and matching, I think it was gold or silver that year, I can't remember, but like hot, splashy clothes, and made a very grand entrance during the warm-up, paraded around the entire venue, carrying each other, whoop, whoop, ha-ha, yay, running, running, running. And so it felt like Portland had a lot of energy around acroyoga, so that seems like maybe they want to maybe move the festival to that area where there's a large community already there.
And from hearing the story, I'd say not just energy, but organization as well.
Yes. They make a t-shirt every year. They started that t-shirt thing.
Now, you'd mentioned that you went to school in Oregon. Was it Portland?
In Eugene.
In Eugene. Were you familiar with Portland before you went?
My brother lived in Portland, Oregon.
So I'd imagine that was probably helpful if you're going to move a venue.
Yes, very much so.
Moving to a place that you have no information, no experience with is probably pretty challenging.
Yes. I feel really lucky that I started to contact venues, found the Oregon Convention Center, and it was open on the dates we wanted. It's always been the second weekend of October, and they were available. I'm like, okay, here we go. No idea. We'd never done it at a convention center with that much actual support. The convention center is extremely helpful as far as the back end of things.
Festivals right now are they're the new hot thing. Everyone's got a festival. Everyone's trying to put on a festival. For the people that have this idea that, oh, I'm just going to, you know, post some things on Facebook and lots of people will show up, can you talk a little bit, broad strokes, about the challenges or the work that goes into putting on a festival?
The challenges, what goes into a festival is a lot more planning than people realize. A lot of people pick a date, pick a venue, have this amazing pipe dream, which sometimes definitely comes true, that all these people are going to sponsor them and give them money and products, and it's going to just be like this festival on this day and it's this, and they forget about actually taking into account all of the actual background expenses. Depending on what kind of festival, do you need mats? Do you need tables and chairs? Do you need people to help organize? How are you going to sell your tickets? It's quite a bit more than putting on the Facebook event. That's actually one of the last things I do.
Do you need money up front to be able to get the festival to happen? And where does that money go?
Typically for the working within the convention center, yes, we have to pay a deposit as soon as we reserve the date. And then we make two payments throughout the year, half and then the other half the week before the actual event. So you do need to know exactly how much that's going to cost you. And then you got to work out your budget from there, because I would recommend that you don't try to just break even, that you maybe make a little profit to build into your next year's festival.
Is that deposit non-refundable?
Yes.
So you have to have the money, you have to be committed to the project, because that money's not coming back.
Yeah, and if you're working within a convention center, the deposit can be anywhere from $5,000 to $10,000, and it is not refundable. So even if you decide as it gets closer that you're going to pull your event, you've already committed a few thousand dollars that you're not going to get back.
And I'm assuming there's money going to things like marketing materials and brochures and paying for websites and getting other people involved. And so there's a fair amount of expenses that are going to go into it.
Definitely. There's a lot more expenses than you realize. You also need insurance for the event. You need to know, like, if you're paying for the parking, are people paying to park there? How do they get there? Travel costs, not only for yourself, but the staff that you would want to work with. There's so many details, like my brain right now. I'm like, whoa, which thing should I tell you? There's a lot.
This is going to be the second year of the Jamaica Divine Play, so you probably have a very fresh memory of putting on the first one last year. Would you mind talking a little bit about that?
Yes. Jamaica. I personally love Jamaica, the culture, the people, the natural beauty. I immediately felt like it was a good venue location-wise for the festival. I would say that I definitely did not take into account that I come from a very Western culture where I email and I think that people are going to email me back in 48 hours. Working with Jamaica, I'm pretty convinced that they invented island time. And I would write emails and make phone calls and not actually hear anything for 5 weeks. It was a little disconcerting on that level. It was having done the Acro Yoga Festival in Portland for 4 years, I did have the thought that Jamaica would be a lot easier. Like, I know how this goes. To turn out that when you move an event internationally to a community that you haven't actually worked with, nothing goes the way that you think it's going to go. It was extremely challenging as far as marketing. People were like, Jamaica, it sounds amazing. Sounds amazing. Sounds amazing. Still sounds amazing. Don't want to go. And it was very, very challenging importing mats because it's Acro Yoga. We need to have a surface that's safe for everybody. Bringing mats into another country, paying customs fees, trusting that people that you've never met are going to show up at the customs at the right time and get the mats out of customs and then pay that entry fee into the country, get them to your location. When I arrived in Jamaica the first year, the first thing I did was go see the mats, and I actually like took them out and jumped up and down and did handstands and headstands. It's like, I have the mats, it worked, they're really here. And when I got there, everything just naturally started to fall more into place. What I learned from that particular event is I really just needed to go to Jamaica 2 weeks early because I could have done the majority of that work right then on the ground in person.
When you have an event and it's the first event or in the first few years, a lot of people, it seems like, are waiting to find out if it's been successful, to hear other people's experiences, to find out if they actually want to go and commit themselves. So it can be challenging in the beginning to get people to your specialness. Okay, so you mentioned earlier the AcroFit, that you are the program director of AcroFit. Tell me again what AcroFit is.
Partner acrobatic fitness that's accessible to all people just regardless of your level of fitness. So it's definitely partner-based. Jason Niemer and I have been working on this project together with the help of many, many other Acro Yoga teachers over the years to develop the program. Finding out what is suitable for various populations, what fits into various levels. It's a super fun way to work out and make new friends at the same time.
And Jason Niemer is a co-founder of Acro Yoga.
Yes.
I guess I should say AYI, Acro Yoga International.
Yes.
Now, AcroFit did not exist a few years ago. So you are starting from the very beginning and trying to introduce a new modality to people. Talk a little bit about that experience.
Initially, it didn't exist. And then at a teacher training level 2, a lot of teachers got together and started to develop what would seem like curriculum for AcroFit. And then through the years, it's been more like a demo run, trying it out, being like, oh, whoa, that's way too much. It turns out that people, when you're working out really and getting sweaty, not everybody wants to do everything that we think in Acro Yoga that you would want to do. So figuring out what levels of intimacy are appropriate. People are really drawn to the aspect of doing push-ups with another person. It provides a fun way and a way to hold each other accountable.
So people that come from the yoga background and people that start to enjoy Acro Yoga become very comfortable with the physical contact, with hugging, with things like that. And so you're trying to introduce the AcroFit to a different population who are not so comfortable with that sort of thing.
Definitely.
Who are you trying to introduce AcroFit to?
Well, in a large sense, I believe we're trying to introduce it to anybody who wants to work out. More specifically, bringing it into the gym culture, into fitness centers, into CrossFit, things where people don't have physical contact, where they're lifting heavy metal objects instead of people, and just changing that paradigm that you can work out with less equipment and your friends and still get the same benefits.
How is it being received?
I would say 90% of the people we've introduced it to have been like, oh my gosh, I had no idea that this could be that fun. There are the few people who are like, nope, not for me. And it probably is just not for them yet. Maybe it's just not for them ever. But I would say overall, it's really well received.
Now, the people that respond enthusiastically to it, what are they really appreciating and enjoying about it?
I find that most people, in addition to just finding out that, like, for example, back to the push-ups, that push-ups with two other people on the ground as your support on the earth, people like that element. I find also what people are really enjoying is there are that acrobatic element where people are lifted up off the ground in a way. A lot of people, if they're not coming from an Acro Yoga background, are like, oh my gosh, I had no idea I could fly. And whether that be in a front plank and someone's doing squats or standing on someone's shins and you're the person doing the squats, just that the knowledge that you can elevate yourself up off the earth, be supported by another person, and develop that own trust, not only with yourself, but with your partner.
Now, within the yoga world, It's fairly common for people to introduce a new style. They revolutionize yoga by introducing a new style. And you've taken that same idea and taken it one step further, not only introducing a new style, but actually a whole new method. And so there's no base population that's already aware of what you're doing and who you are that you can appeal to. So you're starting essentially from the ground to build your population base.
I would say that's largely true. There's a lot of people who do like body weight calisthenic type workouts, and that population is much more adaptable to the AcroFit almost right away because they can take that level of body weight calisthenics right into another person and they can see that direct correlation. There is definitely some, like, I guess convincing, for the lack of a better word, like, no, really, you want to try this. Really, you will get stronger. You'll feel it, I promise. And giving little taster demos has been super beneficial.
So the body weight fitness population, are they easier to convince than the weightlifting population, or is there other people that are easier to sell the idea to?
I think the weightlifting population is open to the idea, but they want to see the benefits. Am I going to get stronger? What's it going to do for my abs? What about my arms, my biceps, my triceps? That kind of thing. They have that coming from that awareness. A lot of people doing workouts in a gym are there because they want to be stronger. They want to lose weight. They want to have a certain definition level in their body. So being able to address all of that fitness aspect within the partner thing has been a little bit of like challenging to figure out like where that crossover is.
A lot of people that work out gyms, classes, it can often be a very individualized experience, even if you're surrounded by a group of people. And having done AcroFit myself, and I'm now a certified AcroFit teacher, I can say that the experience is a lot more community-based. And I could probably say the same thing say the same thing about yoga, which is it's a very individualized experience. And then moving to AcroFit or AcroYoga, it becomes more of a community experience. Does that impact people's enjoyment or lack of when they go into it?
I have found that the majority of people, when they come into an AcroFit class, are actually really surprised at the level of connection that they can make really quickly within a room of people they don't know, because we do work with different partners. We encourage and invite people to work with different people. And realizing that within a partnership, you can make that exercise as challenging or as easy as you want if you're willing to have an open line of communication. And to correct you, you're an AcroFit trainer.
Thank you. Thank you. AcroFit trainer. Thank you. Let's take a moment and tell the world, if they want to learn more about Amy Impellizzeri, how can they do so?
I would say the best way would be to send me an email at amyiacro@gmail.com. I do private consulting for those of you out there who are wanting to start a festival. That's the best way to contact me.
And you do live in a van, and so you do travel around. If someone wanted to have Amy come by and teach, how could they reach you? Same way?
Same way.
And I mentioned briefly that you have a traveling partner. Would you talk a little bit about Eddie?
Yes. Recently just got married to Eddie Salguero. He is also an AcroYoga teacher and AcroFit trainer. The best thing about Eddie is if I cook in the van, he does all the dishes, so my hands are nice and warm in the winter. And he's really good at taking care of those little details that allow me to focus more on the big picture.
Do the two of you teach together?
I would say about 85% of the time we do teach together. As he's gotten more recently certified, he's starting to branch out a little bit and build his own teaching aside from me, which I feel is very important that I step back and let him grow independently as a teacher as well, and then it brings more to our personal teaching together.
I think that's a really valuable point you'd mentioned it before about needing some private time, some alone time when you're traveling together, but also when you have a co-teaching relationship, that it's necessary for the two teachers to go out and have their own experience to be able to bring something unique. Otherwise, you start sounding like each other.
Yes, and I also came into the teaching with, I don't know, maybe 20 more years of teaching experience. So a little bit, I found myself being over teacherly with him and constantly like well, if you could, and what if, and not allowing him to find his own voice. So the more I've stepped back, actually, the more he's been able to step up.
If you would go through the upcoming events that you are involved with.
I have a really exciting event with Betty Salguero and Nosa. We are going to be going to Kenya in Nairobi, working with the Africa Yoga Project. We'll be offering an elemental immersion and an acrofit training with 3 days in between, where we'll go out and feed the giraffes and elephants, go to the birthplace of humanity. Those events, you can email me for information about them or find them both on Facebook. April 18th to 23rd is the second Acro Yoga Festival in Jamaica. We're selling tickets currently right now at a really affordable price. There's 50 of those amazing tickets, and there's actually only 37 or so left. Divine Play Acro Yoga Festival in Portland, Oregon, October 6th through the 8th. I have a lot of other little things, but those are definitely the highlights that I know of.
All right, so we're going to shift the conversation a little bit, talking specifically to people that are on the teaching path within yoga or within another discipline related to yoga. Would you consider yourself an introvert or an extrovert?
Can I be an introverted extrovert?
Sure.
I'm definitely more of an extrovert, I think.
How many hours per week do you feel that you work?
Specifically for the Acro Yoga International, I work 40 hours a week. When it's closer to festivals, I don't actually want to add up how many hours a week. And then I have my own personal, like, building of my own workshops that add maybe 10 or so more hours.
So for someone going into the festival world thinking it'd be easy, little effort put into it and lots of reward, they're misguided.
Yes, you probably want to email me before you get overly ambitious so I can help you and aim your ambition in the more efficient directions.
Okay, so specifically with respect to your teaching, how many hours per week do you spend teaching and how many hours per week do you spend preparing for teaching?
It's super varied because of my traveling schedule. I'll go a little window of time without actually teaching at all right now. Like for January, I'm taking the entire month off from teaching just to refocus and like tune into myself, practice, because I know that February, March, April, May, June, July, like I'll be teaching upwards of 20 plus hours a week.
A large portion of your time spent on your yoga business is spent in the planning and the preparation for upcoming events. And I think it's probably skewed more in your situation because you are dealing specifically with festivals, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, quick and dirty little pieces of advice that you can offer teachers with respect to certain topics. For teachers, any advice you can give them with respect to life balance?
It's really important as a teacher, in my personal opinion, that if you're teaching a lot of yoga or acro yoga or whatever it might be, that you also keep taking that personal time to practice for yourself first so that you are constantly refilling your cup. Because as a teacher, you're giving a lot, and it's important to give that same attention to yourself.
Now, a lot of people feel a concern or anxiety because they're always worried that they're not going to have enough money, and then they go and they immerse themselves in teaching many, many hours. Any advice on that scenario?
That falls back into that before you jump full force into your yoga teaching career. And initially, as a yoga teacher, you will run around and teach way a lot of classes. I did it in the beginning as well, 18 classes a week, which is, like, for me, was way a lot. I would recommend the balance so that you're not financially stressed about the yoga teacher aspect, that maybe you have a part-time job that you know is going to pay your bills, and then you can keep showing up in those yoga classes with the joy of teaching, and you're not so concerned with counting the numbers and doing the math in your head, like, oh my gosh, I'm only making $37 right now, that kind of thing, just because it can be a little bit stressful, and if you bring that energy to your class, you're not going to build your career further.
Advice for teachers with respect to travel.
I find it super helpful to reach out to the areas you want to go to and connect with the local teachers there. They will be your best resource of information on where that community is and what they might be interested in having. I've found personally for me as an Acro Yoga traveling teacher that I have more success in workshops when I reach out to other Acro Yoga teachers in the area and collaborate with them as opposed to just bombarding their community with what I think needs to happen.
If you would, I think that's an interesting perspective. Take a moment to elaborate a little bit more about working with local teachers when you come to travel in.
I often will do either a Google search or now it's Facebook searching of that area and write an email expressing that I'm interested in coming, giving a window of time, would they be interested in doing some sort of collaboration, and then seeing yes or no. A lot of teachers will want to collaborate, and then maybe we co-share some of the sessions over a weekend. I've reached out to other communities where teachers are much more willing to not necessarily collaborate, but host me as a guest teacher. And then I come in and teach those poor birds. Come in to teach a weekend with them, not necessarily taking over their community, but like with their guidance of what is of value at their community right now.
Okay, and lastly, before we wrap this up, because some of the people might have heard a little bit of noise, would you tell people where we are right now?
Right now we are sitting in Kailua, Honolulu, in an upstairs, very new, renovated apartment that has full windows all the way around. We can see palm trees, a lot of mountains, and that weird noise is the birds running into the windows, unfortunately. I think they're all okay, though. It's a little bit cloudy. It's quite beautiful. It's not a bad place to have an office today.
So one of the advantages to being a traveling teacher is that sometimes you work looking at extinct volcanoes from your window.
Yes, definitely.
Any last things that you would like to add for the people listening?
I think it's really important to take those moments daily and check in with your own self and make sure that the choices you make are of service to you first so that you're more available to be of service to others. It's okay to ask other people for help, advice about guidance and how to structure classes if you're not sure. And it's okay to not know the answer.
It's okay to not know the answer. That's good. Amy, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with me.
Yeah, thank you, Brian. This was really fun.
Good. I would like to thank Amy for taking the time to sit with me in beautiful Kailua, Hawaii. I would also like to thank her husband, Eddie Salguero, for providing the introduction to this show. I always enjoy spending time with them and appreciate Amy's willingness to provide some of her history and information to this podcast. I would also like to thank one of my personal sponsors, Prana Clothing Company. They produce yoga, travel, and adventure clothes with a conscience. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. We've got a few interesting conversations that'll be coming up over the next few months.